You're about to have a new audio experience. Same podcast you love, with a few new audio tweaks. ...28-year-old Donovan de Jong was a vulnerable man living with intellectual disabilities in the Western Cape when he was lured into a vehicle with three men with the promise of some takeaway food for dinner. What followed was an incredibly horrendous crime, which shocked even those communities who lived among regular gang violence on a daily basis. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 201, The Murder of Donovan de Jong. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining the Patreon community. Patreon members get free access to TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. You can join the Patreon community from just $2, around 32 rand a month. And if you aren't big on commitment, not only is there a free 7-day trial, but you can also cancel at any time. New Patreon supporters get a shout out when they join. Listen through to the end for that. Patreon.com/True Crime South Africa. Please. And thank you. This is the first episode in which you're hearing a few new things in the True Crime South Africa general feed. Patreon listeners got the first listen to these changes in their March exclusive episode. I've been running this podcast for almost 7 years, and a lot of its elements, the music, some of the artwork, has stayed the same all that time. I was doing this before podcasts were really anywhere as big as they are now in South Africa, and even across the world. A lot of best practice in podcasting has changed over the years. So I thought the cusp of 200 episodes was a good time to change some stuff up. The intro music you just heard has been created for me by the lovely folks over at Vow FM. And the new disclaimer voice belongs to Karabo Peter. I included that notice in the beginning that you're about to have a new audio experience because I know some folks get very attached with the way stuff sounds, and it can be a bit of a shock to hear something you weren't expecting. I'll play that reminder for about 5 episodes to ease everyone into it. I've also created some new episode artwork and changed up the structure of the episode a bit. Anyway, back to the actual episode. I first heard about this case from retired Captain Jonathan Morris, who you'll have heard me talk about on the podcast before. He's the Sizzler's detective from my book about the case. And I've covered a few of his other successful investigations too. This case really struck me, not just because of the horrendous violence involved, but also because of who the victim was and how he was used and abused by these perpetrators for such revolting ends. In researching this episode, I used a chapter from Jonathan Morris's book, Confess a Cop, several media articles, and several academic sources. So, let's get into episode 201, The Murder of Donovan de Jong.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
Donovan de Jong was born in the Western Cape in 1972. There's very little information about his early life, except the fact that he was born with an intellectual disability which means that his cognitive age was much younger than his physical age throughout his life. He was often bullied and found himself in difficult situations, especially as a child, because of the difference in cognitive abilities between him and his peers, and also how adults expected him to behave a certain way for his age when he simply wasn't capable of that yet. Donovan was adopted by Sharifa and Muhammad Jacobs when he was very young, as his biological family were unable to care for him in the way he needed. Despite the challenges he faced in life, Donovan was well-loved in his community and tried his best to contribute to the household by selling miscellaneous items in the city centre of Mitchell's Plain. The items he sold tended to vary by season, but it was usually razor blades and clothing pegs. These were two items that he'd found over the years people regularly needed and would forget when they went shopping. Donovan, or Donnie, as he was affectionately known by most in the community, was a familiar sight in town, standing at the robot with his black plastic crate in which he carried his wares, from early in the morning until the sun set, when he would make his way back home to the Jacobs. Just two streets away from Donovan's home lived another young man, whose early years had been anything but easy. 18-year-old Melvin Michels should have been matriculating in 2000, but his life had taken him on a different path. Melvin's street nickname was Curly, and he'd been raised by his grandmother after his mother had left his life when he was 3 years old. Melvin had not done well at school at all, and was regularly in trouble for absenteeism and fighting. He was eventually expelled from primary school and never re-enrolled anywhere else to complete his schooling. Melvin's father had never been in his life, and although Melvin was really the perfect candidate, for want of a better phrase, to be groomed by the local street gangs, he'd never joined one, although this hadn't really kept him on the right side of the law either. By the time he turned 18, he had already been convicted of theft a few times, although he hadn't spent any time in juvenile facilities. In a strange way, it may have been this that could have been his saving grace. Many young men who end up in prison, even if they have not yet been involved in gang activity on the outside, will feel forced to join one of the number gangs on the inside for protection. Being a France, as the number calls those who are unaligned with the number inside, means you also become everyone else's slave, essentially. And Frances are often singled out for violence, including sexual assaults in prison. Melvin had avoided all of that by the time he was approaching adulthood, though, and there was still a lot of possibility ahead for him. Unfortunately, Melvin took a job with the wrong man, and that would lead him down a road that could only end in tragedy. The man Melvin worked for also lived across the road from him. Roger Jones had certainly not avoided the gang life like Melvin had. 33-year-old Jones had been in and out of prison for most of his life, and not on petty charges either. In 2000, he was out on parole for a gang-related murder, in which he'd stabbed a rival gang member to death. During his time in prison, Jones had become a 28s member. The 28s are the most vicious and violent of the number, and all their members have committed some type of violent crime, usually murder, in order to be inducted into the gang. Jones hadn't committed the murder he was on parole for alone, though. His longtime friend and fellow 28s member, Anwar Abrahams, had been with him, and he too had served time for that crime and been released on parole by 2000. Abrahams and Jones spent plenty of time together, often either drinking alcohol or smoking a mixture of Mandrax and Dacha. With Melvin often at Jones's house, he too became familiar with Abrahams, and also began to partake in the drug-taking. In 2000, gangs and drugs were a hot topic in the Western Cape. And it's quite important to this case to understand the criminal and civil environment in which events were taking place. In 1996, a group formed on the Cape Flats called People Against Gangsterism and Drugs, or PAGAD. Initially, PAGAD was just a group of ordinary community members who, like most other people living on the Cape Flats, were sick and tired of how gangs and drugs were destroying their communities and the lives of young and old alike. Although the group itself was not political in nature, there were some members who belonged to the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, or PAC. The group said its goal was to organise public protests in order to put pressure on the police and government to stamp out gangsterism and the drug trade. What started as public protests, though, quickly spiralled, and soon some PAGAD members declared that since the authorities were not listening, they would take matters into their own hands. Gangsters and drug dealers were approached by PAGAD and instructed to stop their activities or face the consequences. And when they didn't, the consequences soon became clear. Gang bosses' houses and businesses were set on fire, and murder was just a few steps down that path. Things really escalated when, in 1996, the infamous leader of the Hard Livings gang, Rashad Stachi, was beaten and burned to death by a mob of people who had marched to his house in Salt River. Up until then, the police had almost been standing back and letting PAGAD act, because it seemed to be a good way for the community to get involved. But of course, they could not condone arson and murder. Soon, PAGAD was designated as a terrorist group. But they were certainly far from finished with their quest. And unfortunately, like many organisations that start off with a positive goal in mind, with blood on their hands, things began to splinter. And what emerged was an offshoot of the original organisation, still acting under the original name, but with individuals in charge who were pretty radical. By 2000, PAGAD was at the height of its activities and had almost embraced the terrorist label by beginning a string of bombings in the Western Cape. The group targeted venues which they knew would get a lot of public attention. In 2000, there were 9 such bombings, as well as an assassination of a magistrate who was presiding over a PAGAD-related case in the courts. Although the people of Mitchell's Plain and the Cape Flats had initially been behind PAGAD and its mission, it had become clear to most that they could no longer put their support behind something which was now targeting innocent people, just doing their jobs or living their lives. It was clearly no longer about rooting out gangsterism and drug dealers. But this is what was happening in the Western Cape, and specifically on the Cape Flats during the time in question. Gangsters and drug dealers were still very much at war with PAGAD, and always looking over their shoulders. And soon, one of the men we've met so far was going to try to cash in on the complex atmosphere in the area. In August 2000, Roger Jones was struggling financially. He had a conversation with his girlfriend one night in which he told her that he was sick of never having any money, and he had an idea to produce a constant flow of money by cashing in on the current fear running through most drug dealers on the Cape Flats. He told her that he was going to create a situation in which he would make local drug dealers feel like they were being targeted, so that he could make them pay him protection money. His girlfriend would later claim he hadn't given her any details about what he had in mind, but considering drug dealers are a pretty tough bunch, it would clearly have to be something pretty significant. It was this conversation that would later prove that what had happened next was absolutely premeditated. On the morning of the 17th of August 2000, Melvin Michels went across the road to his boss Roger Jones's house. Anwar Abrahams arrived shortly afterwards, and the three men spent most of the day drinking and smoking a combination of Mandrax and Dacha. By late afternoon, they started getting hungry, and all three piled into Jones's car and headed into the Mitchells Plain CBD. Melvin stayed in the car, while Anwar and Roger went into a takeaway to purchase a Gatsby for them to share. Melvin said that the men did come back with the food, but they also came back with someone else tagging along. Abrahams and Jones told him that they had crossed paths with Donovan de Jong as he was selling his wares at the Robot, and asked him if he'd like to join them for some food and drinks. Donovan had been out in the sun the whole day, and was tired, thirsty, and hungry. He also figured that Roger Jones's house was just a few streets down from his own home anyway, so once he'd eaten and visited for a while, he could just walk home. Melvin said he was surprised to see Donovan getting into the car with them. He didn't know the man well, but was familiar with them on site, as were so many others in the community. He claims that he too thought that they'd be heading back to Jones's house to eat, smoke some more, and drink. But when the car started moving, he realized that was not where they were going. Roger Jones soon pulled his car into an open grassy area across the road from Lensahir Psychiatric Hospital. There, he and the other men shared the Gatsby and sat for a while, drinking alcohol he had in the car and smoking dacha. As darkness began to settle, Melvin said that Anwar Abrahams told him and Donovan to go for a walk with him. Melvin asked where they were going, and Abraham said he just wanted to smoke some more and stretch his legs. Jones stayed in the car. Melvin said that Abrahams had walked into some denser trees and then lit up a dacha and mandrax pipe and encouraged Donovan to take a drag of it. As Donovan lifted the pipe to his mouth and turned his head, Anwar Abrahams began to stab him in the neck with a broken bottleneck. Donovan turned, confused, and tried to fend off the attack, but Abrahams kicked the man in the back, and Donovan stumbled to the ground, clutching his neck. While Melvin ran back to the car and told Roger Jones what had just happened, Jones didn't look surprised. Just then, Abrahams walked up to the car too. He leaned in and told Jones that they needed to quickly go to that friend he had with the saw. Melvin said he didn't understand the reference, but was happy that the men were talking about leaving because he was afraid and confused as to what was happening. The three men piled in the car with no further sign of Donovan, but their trip was short. Melvin said they drove just around the corner to a house, and Jones went inside and came back out with the handsaw. He put it in the boot and drove back to the field opposite Lensahir Psychiatric Hospital. There, Melvin said, both Jones and Abrahams got out of the car, grabbed the saw, and instructed him to get out and go with them. I will warn you that the following details are very difficult to listen to. Melvin said that when they returned to the scene, Donovan de Jong was still alive. He was laying in the bushes where they'd left him, but he'd lost a lot of blood and was audibly struggling to breathe. Melvin said he was instructed to sit on Donovan's legs, and Roger Jones held his arms down. Anwar Abrahams then took the saw to Donovan's neck and began to decapitate him. Melvin estimated that it took about 10 to 20 minutes for Abrahams to completely sever Donovan's head from his body. He couldn't say when Donovan had stopped moving and provided no information about the man's reaction to being so viciously attacked. When the head is severed completely from the body, it is difficult to rule out possible initial strangulation as the actual cause of death. But Melvin Michel's eventual testimony would make it clear that, according to him, Donovan had been showing signs of life up until the moment Abrahams had taken the saw to his neck. And the forensic pathologist would later rule the cause of death as decapitation. It is almost impossible to know exactly when Donovan died during this process and how much he may have suffered. In the case of swift decapitation, such as the previously used method of capital punishment in some countries of beheading, death is immediate. The blood pressure to the brain drops to zero almost instantly. Consciousness is likely lost within 2 to 3 seconds due to the rapid fall of intracranial blood perfusion and the shock to the nervous system. With gradual decapitation of this nature, though, while the victim is still alive, death will more than likely come from exsanguination or loss of blood. Depending on where on the neck the severing begins, one of the main arteries may be hit quite quickly, and significant blood loss could cause loss of consciousness within a short period. The vast majority of murderers who attempt dismemberment of any kind for the first time often misjudge just how much effort and time it takes to dismember a human body, and most ordinary tools are not built for the task, as well they shouldn't be. Because the task is so labor-intensive and time-consuming, a gradual decapitation like this will not always happen all at the same time. So, again, it makes it very difficult to ascertain exactly how much Donovan may have been aware of during this time. We really can only hope that there was a rupture of a main artery very early on in this horrendous act, and he passed away relatively quickly. Melvin Michels said that when the decapitation was complete, Jones and Abrahams had instructed him to place the head into a cardboard box and then put it into the black crate that Donovan used to use to sell his wares in town. They then told him that he was to take the gruesome package to a well-known local drug dealer, one Brian Kahn. There would be 3 sightings of 1 or 2 tall men with a package that contained a head that night. The first was at the premises of Brian Kahn, where his security personnel, who stood watch at the entrance to the house, were approached by 2 men they later identified as Michels and Jones. The men had asked to see Brian Kahn, but the security guards insisted on checking the contents of the box they had with them first. When they opened it up and found the severed head inside, they began to assault Michels and Jones, chasing them down the road, beating them with broomsticks while Michels clung to the black crate. At the next reported sighting, Jones had disappeared, and Michels would later confirm that Jones had felt that the message would now get back to Kahn, who was in fact the target of his fear campaign for protection money, and he instructed Michels to continue on and sow as much fear as he could among the gangsters in the area, and then dispose of Donovan's head. A woman who was walking home that night said Melvin Michels had approached her on AZ Berman Drive that night, around 6 p.m, and asked her if she wanted to buy a sheep's head and hooves. She declined, and I cannot fathom what Michels thought he would do if she had agreed and asked to see the contents of the box before buying it. Just 15 minutes later, the same woman would witness the aftermath of Melvin Michels' 3rd encounter of the night. The street gang that operated predominantly in the area Michels was walking around in at that time was called the Junior Cisco Yuckies Gang. Jones had thought it was a good idea to also show these individuals what they'd done in the hopes that they too would be concerned and maybe they'd also pay him protection money or at least they wouldn't intervene in his dealings with Brian Kahn. Unfortunately for Melvin Michels, one of the gang members he approached that night on Jones's instruction was the son-in-law of a bouncer who worked for Brian Kahn. And the man's father-in-law had phoned him just after they'd chased Michels and Jones away and told his son-in-law about the terrible scene they'd just witnessed. So when the young man saw Michels coming towards them with the black crate, he already knew what was in the box. And the gang descended on Michels, beating him up. Michels managed to get down the road to a house and dumped the crate in the backyard of an unsuspecting resident. 15 minutes after the woman had been approached by Michels with what he had alleged was a sheep head for sale, she came across him again. This time, the crate was gone, and Melvin was lying on the pavement, seemingly having passed out from a combination of his injuries from the beating and very high alcohol levels. An ambulance was called for him, and he was taken to the hospital. Around the same time, a resident who lived next door to where Melvin had dropped the crate alerted his neighbour that someone had been in her garden and left something behind. The homeowner went to investigate, and of course we know by now what a horrific sight awaited her. Her screams of horror soon had an enormous crowd gathering around her house. Thankfully, police responded very quickly and were able to cordon off the area and stop too many people from looking inside the package. But as news rippled around the crowd that there was a severed head in the crates, it became almost impossible to hold the crowd back. The currents of disputes that had been running through the community and never quite knowing when something was going to happen was still deeply ingrained, and the residents wanted to know who had been killed so they could figure out whose door needed to be knocked on. The two young officers on the scene wanted to leave the package in situ for forensic officers to analyse, but it was simply too risky, with the crowd pressing at the garden gate. So they made the decision to quickly transport the package to the police station. Of course, the crowd followed them there, and soon stood in the parking lot, demanding to know the identity of the victim. By then, one of the top investigating officers in the province had been called, and he arrived shortly afterwards. Captain Jonathan Morris was not yet a captain at this point. That promotion would come 3 years later, after he'd solved the Sizzlers case. He was still incredibly experienced and well-respected, though, when he walked into Mitchell's Plain police station. And although he'd investigated hundreds of cases, and at that point was handling 10 murder cases himself, it was the first time he was about to see a decapitated head. The most disturbing case of Morris's career was also still to come. During the trial of the Sizzlers' murderers, he would admit that that was the most gruesome scene and the most disturbing case he'd ever worked on. But when he was shown into the room where the decapitated head of the victim was being stored and peered into the box, he felt a wave of horror and nausea overwhelm him. After taking a few minutes to recover, Morris was back on track. The first port of call, of course, as in any murder investigation, was to identify the victim. While they had the option of photographing the victim's face and sending it through the facial recognition system, that would have taken a lot of time. And Morris had a different, albeit less high-tech, idea. He had to push his way through the large crowd outside when he'd arrived, and he knew very well that the community were often useful in solving cases. And so, it was to the crowd that Morris went. Standing outside, surveying the crowd, he identified three of the oldest women and asked them to come inside. In his experience, the more elderly women in the community were often the very best sources of information. They usually knew almost everyone, and also often knew everyone's business too. Morris sat the women down and explained that he could use their help in identifying the victim, but they had to know that what they were about to see was truly horrific. The women said that they understood that it would be a terrible sight, but they wanted to help if they could. Thankfully, the first woman to look in the box very quickly identified the victim. She gasped and shouted, "It's Donnie." Within a few minutes, Jonathan Morris had all the information he could gather in one place about the victim, Donovan de Jong. The information moved through the community very quickly, and within an hour, Donovan's parents arrived at the police station to find out whether what they were hearing was true, and Jonathan had to confirm the worst possible news. Donovan's father also confirmed the identification. Jonathan put out a call through various points to the community for them to provide any information or sightings that might assist the investigation. Quickly, the woman whom Malvin had approached in the street to buy what he claimed was a sheep's head put two and two together and called in to the police station. She identified Malvin and told Morris that she'd seen him laying in the street and was aware that he'd been taken away by ambulance. Morris made contact with the local ambulance service, and they pointed him to the hospital they dropped Malvin off at. Unfortunately, when Morris arrived at the hospital, he discovered that Malvin Michels was much too intoxicated to talk to him. But he was at least able to secure the clothing Michels had been wearing as evidence. He instructed the staff not to release the man until he'd had the chance to question him in the morning. The next morning, while Jonathan Morris was following up on a few other leads, he got a call to say that two police officers had gone to Malvin Michels' home to advise his grandmother that he was in hospital and find out what they could about him and his associates. The woman had quickly told them that he usually hung out with his boss, Roger Jones, who lived across the road, and instead of contacting Jonathan to find out how he wanted them to proceed, they went straight across and confronted Roger Jones. Almost unbelievably, Jones confessed to knowing about Donovan de Jong's murder and even handed over the clothing that he'd been wearing the previous day. He admitted that there'd been a third person present, Anwar Abrahams. Again, the two officers, now seemingly on a roll, proceeded to Abrahams' home and arrested him too, without involving Jonathan. And all of this would have been absolutely fine if they hadn't failed to do one very important thing at Abraham's home. They did not seize the clothing he'd been wearing the day before. And this would become a crucial error. Investigating officer Jonathan Morris was eventually called that day and advised that two suspects had been taken into custody, and Jones had provided a location for Donovan's remains. Morris rushed out to the field across from Lensicare Hospital and met the officers there. There they found Donovan's decapitated body lying in the bushes. Morris recalls seeing that Donovan's hands were clenched into fists and thinking how unusual that was. Like the decapitation, he had never seen that before, nor since. From the scene, Morris went to the hospital where Malvin Michels was now capable of communicating, but refusing to do so. He was clearly terrified, Morris said. He officially placed Michels under arrest and told him that as soon as he was released from the hospital, he would be taken into custody and put into prison to await trial. Then Morris went back to the police station and interviewed Roger Jones, who, although happy to provide a confession of sorts, was distancing himself from anything involving the actual murder. He claimed he'd been asleep in his car the entire time that the murder must have been happening, and he'd had no idea Abrahams and Michels had killed Donovan until he'd seen the bloodied box in his boots. He also claimed that he'd had nothing to do with the head being taken to Khan's premises and was never there. Morris did not believe him, but he would wait for the forensics to come back. If he could find some type of proof that linked Jones to Donovan's body, or perhaps get a full confession from one of the others, he was sure he could prove the truth. Jonathan's interview with Anwar Abrahams did not go very well. The man was very aggressive and denied any involvement at all. Jonathan eventually asked him why he had been such a coward, that he would target a vulnerable young man rather than go after a fellow gangster who could fight back. The interview ended there. Over the next few weeks, the forensic evidence results started to come back. Fingerprints linked Jones, Michaels and Abrahams to Jones's car, which had of course been at the scene and transported Donovan's head. But the blood and DNA evidence only positively linked Jones and Michaels to Donovan's blood. Jones claimed he had only had it on his clothes because he touched the crate, but Morris was pretty sure that wasn't true. He just had to find a way to prove it. Shortly after this, Morris visited and interviewed Jones's girlfriend, and she then told him about that plan Jones had come up with to create the protection racket among the local drug dealers. Morris had noticed that Brian Kahn, despite now knowing that the decapitated head had not been an actual message to him, seemed to still have upped his security. Perhaps he figured that if one person was willing to go to those lengths to drum up a need for protection money, it might not be too long before someone else tried it too. Despite Morris's best efforts, he was unable to find any more evidence against Anwar Abrahams. Jones was claiming he had no first-hand knowledge of what had happened. Michaels was terrified, and there was no physical evidence to tie Abrahams to it. So, the prosecutor told him they would have to drop the charges against Abrahams and let him go. Jonathan Morris was very upset about this. Donovan was exactly the type of victim he dedicated his career to fighting for justice for. Vulnerable, bullied, just trying to make a life for himself, and caught up in a horrific attack by ruthless gangsters. As the weeks passed and the trial of Michaels and Jones loomed, he never stopped thinking about ways he could get Anwar Abrahams back in the dock. Then, in February 2002, a new prosecutor was appointed to the case, and a telephone call from them to Morris changed everything. In 2002, a new piece of legislation had just been implemented for action in South Africa. The legislation allowed what was then referred to as a plea bargain, but is now called a plea deal, to make it sound less like a 50% off sale on chocolate eggs after Easter, I guess. And fair enough. I think because plea deals have now become so commonplace, I was actually really surprised that this was the first time they'd been used in South Africa. Up until then, there'd been a bit of pushback against the idea, as some of the legal community were concerned it might result in false confessions, or it might be used by gang members to set up their rivals. But after a lot of discussion and research, and drawing from how the legislation had been used in the US, by the time plea deals became available in South Africa, most of the legal community was happy that prosecutors would be able to pass out any fake claims through the evidence. As failsafes, the legislation also required that the investigating officer and the victim or victim's family be consulted before a deal was struck. The idea was that the plea deals would help speed up certain trials and free up resources within the justice system. The plea deal pilot projects had been established in the Western Cape, KZN and Eastern Cape to start off with, and prosecutors in those provinces were looking through current cases to find the perfect one to use as the first plea deal in South African legal history. And this was the reason for the phone call to Jonathan Morris that changed everything. The new prosecutor on Donovan de Jong's case had been looking at the three suspects and agreed with Morris that it would be a travesty of justice to have Abrahams walk free. Mickles, on the other hand, they believed, was a young man who did not have hard gang connections and was likely in the wrong place at the wrong time. He had, of course, agreed to do some pretty horrendous things that night. But his age, lack of gang affiliations, and lack of prior record made them hopeful that, given the opportunity, he could be rehabilitated and turn his life around. And so Morris agreed to see if he could get Mickles to accept the second chance. By the time Jonathan Morris got into Polesmoor to see Melvin Mickles, he had been awaiting trial for almost 2 years. The visit was the first he'd had from anyone while he was in there. Morris's arrival at the prison was prearranged, and it was all done in a very cloak-and-dagger way. Not because they were doing anything wrong, but because if anyone inside the prison found out that Mickles was meeting with the police officer, he could be in deep trouble inside. Mickles had no idea Morris was coming, and he was already shaking with fear when the police officer slid in a side door and into an empty office, which had been allocated for their secret meeting. The young man, a teenager still really, was the perfect candidate for the fatherly role Morris was notorious for taking during interviews. It was what led to almost all of the confessions he'd gotten throughout his career as a detective. Despite what Melvin Mickles had been involved in, what he saw before him in that interview room was really just a lost boy. A boy who had had very few decent role models, and sadly had found himself in the clutches of a cold-blooded gang member who would happily have thrown him under the proverbial bus without a second thought. So Morris launched into explaining the deal he proposed. He explained to Melvin that they had more than enough evidence to sentence him to life in prison, even if he never said another word. It seemed unfair to him, though, that the man who he thought had played a major role, Anwar Abrahams, wouldn't serve a single day in prison. Upon hearing this, Melvin was horrified and blurted out that he was the one who killed Donovan. And at that moment, Morris knew he had him. When he walked out of Polesmoor that day, he had helped to secure justice for Donovan de Jong and make legal history. Melvin Mickles never went back into the cells at Polesmoor. It was far too risky. From his secret office meeting, he was whisked away to what was then Victor Verster Correctional Centre and is now Drakenstein Correctional Centre. There, he could more easily be isolated from negative influences, and gang members couldn't get to him. It would be a far better place for him to serve out the time he would undoubtedly still get, but in a way that would give him a better chance at turning his life around. Anwar Abrahams was arrested and charged with murder just a few days later. Jonathan quite enjoyed snapping the cuffs around the man's wrists and leading him away, while Abrahams tried to downplay his own concern by asking if he could finish his beer before he was taken away. The beer remained half full on his friend's kitchen counter. On the 18th of March 2002, Anwar Abrahams and Roger Jones arrived for what they very likely believed was going to be an ordinary pre-trial hearing. Instead, as they sat in the dock, legal history played out, as a still very scared Melvin Mickles was brought into the witness box to begin testifying. Mickles and his counsel, as well as Donovan's parents, I.O. Jonathan Morris, and the prosecutor, had agreed to request a sentence of 15 years for Mickles in exchange for his testimony against his co-accused. The final decision always remains with the judge, and if they feel that justice is not being properly served in any way, they can intervene in the plea deal. But in this case, despite his nerves, Melvin was a stellar witness. And with the added physical evidence and testimony from the other witnesses, both Roger Jones and Anwar Abrahams were convicted of all the charges against them. And each was handed down a life sentence. Jonathan had been pained when he'd heard that none of Melvin's family had visited him while he was in Polesmoor for 2 years. And when he inquired with the young man's grandmother, he discovered that it was really just down to a lack of transport and money. She had no way to get there, and no way to raise enough money to pay someone to take her. So, once a month for the rest of the time he was based in Mitchell's Plain, Jonathan Morris collected the woman and took her to see Melvin. On some occasions, Melvin's mom joined too, and Jonathan could only hope that this would be the start of building a stronger family unit to support him when he was released. Plea deals are often questioned by the public, and sometimes it feels like people who shouldn't are getting away with much less time, and they shouldn't be rewarded for telling the truth. But if there's anything I've learned over the last 7 years, when it comes to justice in a court of law, it's not really about what you know. It's about what you can prove. And sometimes, the evidence is just not there to prove a charge, even if you know the person is guilty. It's incredibly frustrating. But it's also an important safeguard in our justice system to reduce the possibility of innocent people being convicted of crimes they did not commit. In crimes where there are multiple people involved, there's almost always someone who is less culpable to an extent, and who would be far less of a danger on the outside than some of the others. In situations like that, it makes sense to use that to secure convictions for the really dangerous people. Sometimes, it's the fastest and easiest way to ensure justice for the victim and allow their family to be able to move forward with their grief. Donovan de Jong was just 28 years old when he was murdered. His intellectual disabilities meant that he was easily manipulated. And on the day he died, all it took was the promise of some food and a few drinks to lure him into the ultimate danger. I'm never keen to turn human beings' lives into hashtags or monuments to what they achieved through their deaths. Donovan was far more valuable to everyone in his community alive. He was a good man. He was loved and cherished by his adoptive parents and worked hard to make a contribution to his household, despite not having all of the same abilities many others do. He should not have become the victim of this horrific crime. But Jones and Abrahams made sure he did become their victim. They thought Donovan's life was better served through their own means and to make them richer. What they could never have bargained on was the profound impact that Donovan's life and his death would have on our legal system. And to be fair, every victim's case that came after that, which was able to be brought to court because of a plea deal struck, which helped to uphold the truth. Donovan de Jong may have only lived for 28 years, and there may be fewer people who remember him now, 25 years later. But every single time a plea deal is struck across South Africa, Donovan's memory is alive in that courtroom. There should never have been a case to convict his murderers, because he never should have been murdered. But thousands of victims have seen and will see justice because Donovan lived. Donovan de Jong, rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. TCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform. And if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za and support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.